Today we're going to continue with our series and talk about a very important and sensitive topic. The series that we've been dealing with are topics that reflect or issues that are specific to our Masorah, to our community. And we, at the beginning of this journey, we identified that there are certain features of our Masorah, namely the concept of nuance versus black and white, the relationship between Kodesh and Chol, and the idea of human creativity, perhaps having to do with Yeshuva Shel Olam and the involvement of people in history. Those three ideas have what you would call in halacha nafkaminas. They have practical applications in terms of how we see the community that we live in. So far, we've talked about secular studies, we've talked about religious Zionism, a whole host of issues. And today, we're going to talk about non-observant Jews. What is the attitude, or what is an attitude, within our community, within our Masorah, to non-traditional Jews? Now, for anyone to do an authoritative, extensive presentation on this topic, you would need a source packet that looked like this. The Orthodox Forum has two whole books in the last 20 years on this topic, a collection of essays, and one of those essays in that book is a bibliography of this topic. So there is, one of them is called Jewish Tradition and the Non-Traditional Jew, and the other one is called The Relationship of Orthodox Jews with Believing Jews of Other Religious Ideologies and Non-Believing Jews. There is a ton, literally endless Torah that has been explored in this context. Last year, the Gemara that we learned in the Kola was Maseches Chulin. So we actually spent an extensive section of the time dealing with this halachic topic, which in the time of the Gemara, it was usually referred to as someone called a Mumar. Mumar literally means to transfer. He transfers, or she transfers, this person transfers their observance for something else. They are a Mumar, it means they're a heretic, but they're a non-observant. So the Gemara has different categories that we'll talk about. So this is a very, very, very lengthy halachic topic discussed there. And then, a few years ago, we had a little mini conference where the Kolo fellows, we all went to YU for a day, and we had shiurim and lectures and seminars, and Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter led one of the seminars, so of course I kept the packet and put it in the filing cabinet and held on to it. And then we've had discussions within the Kolo. There are tons and tons. I have papers, lots and lots and lots of essays, and so we're not going to, this is not meant to be an exhaustive presentation on the sugya of Mumar, or on all the different ways that we can look at this issue, whether you call these people, we'll talk about talking about chilonim or non-observant or conservative or reconstructionist, whatever labels you're going to use. But I think it is important for us as a community to think about what is our attitude to the people who are different from us when it comes to halachic commitment and also in terms of emunos videos. But I would make an observation, maybe you would call it a sociological observation. You could tell me if it's totally wrong. But I notice in my own anecdotal experience that the relationship that our community has to the non-observant is oftentimes different than other Torah communities have with the non-observant community. And part of what is interesting about it that I notice, take this shul for example. Wonderful congregation. I suspect, when I look around the shul on Shabbos morning, I suspect that if not more, but close to 50% of the members of our shul either did not grow up in a what we would call Orthodox, even though we didn't give the name Orthodox. In the 19th century, it was kind of an imported name. But I would say maybe 50% of the members of the shul didn't come from an Orthodox upbringing, or their parents didn't come from an Orthodox upbringing, or they have close family who are not members of a Frum community?
I think it's higher.
Right? I suspect it's higher, but I'm not going to put labels. I don't go checking people's upbringing in their, you know, their bar mitzvah certificates. But that, to me, is very interesting. And I wonder from a sociological standpoint that maybe part of the reason that our community has people from all of these different paths that come together is that because our community has the features of nuance rather than black and white, well, maybe for some it's easier. For some people, if they're going to choose orthodoxy, they're going to choose more of a black and white model. But for some people who are on a journey, this may be their first step, or this may be the place where they feel most comfortable, also in terms of the relationship between Kodesh and Chol and the concepts of human creativity and Yeshuva Shalom. So it could be, it's not just, well, these are the values, the Torah values that we have developed through our Masorah, and through that lens we're going to look at people who are in the non-observant community. It could be that because we have these values, we actually relate to and are open to and maybe even attract people from a non-observant background that wouldn't necessarily go somewhere else or wouldn't fit into a different Masorah or aren't attracted. They're not interested in a different Masorah. You know, one of the early times we talked months ago, someone came over to me after the shiur and we were talking about, well, how do you find a Masorah? The answer is wherever your neshama takes you. So there are some people who their neshama takes them to Bavavur Chassidus. That's their calling. That's their thing. There are some people that's, and it doesn't matter where they start. And then there are some people who their neshama takes them to Rav Soloveitchik or to Rav Lichtenstein. You know, people have different, they're drawn. You can adopt. It doesn't mean you have to be born into that Masorah. You can adopt it. So there are a lot of people who choose our Masorah. So I think it's interesting when you think about what's the relationship between, you know, our Masorah and people who don't subscribe to Halacha. There is this interesting relationship that there are a lot of people in our community. You know, it's easy when you take a snapshot from the outside and say, well, there's such a variance of practice. There's so many people doing all different kinds of things. Well, part of the reason that there are so many things going on, just take this shul for example, is that because people come from very different points in their own experience and in their own journey. They're at different points. You know, a lot of people in our community and in this room didn't grow up the way that I grew up or the way that others grew up. They grew up with something totally different. And they become part of this community. So I think the way that we look at the non-traditional Jew is going to be also informed by the fact that we have a very special relationship with many non-traditional Jews because they're part and parcel of the fabric of our lives. You know, and therefore, we're interacting with them in a certain way that it's distinct from people who put up a very significant wall and they say, we're going to focus specifically on the inside. And so you can kind of bifurcate your life. We're in a different place, totally, yeah.
Is it not possible that the other 50% are still on a journey?
Oh, everyone.
Finding exactly where
100%.
You're going?
No question. We're all on a journey. But if you were to say, somebody were to look at me, they would say, okay, here's a kid who's from birth. His parents went to a shul. His parents sent him to an Orthodox day school, learned in a yeshiva in Israel, went to YU, became a rabbi. So he's like traditional Orthodox. Parents were Orthodox. Grandparents were Orthodox. Traditional Orthodox upbringing. So hopefully he'll continue to follow that path. But there are a lot of people, and I'm very inspired by these people because, you know, it's easy, in a certain sense, it's easier for me because I had that upbringing. But there are a lot of people we look around, you know, we look around in our own community, in our own shul, in this room, and we say, wow, people who chose this later in life, some of them much later in life, some of them as kids, some teenagers, some later in life. So the way that we relate to non-traditional Jews, we need to look at it from a halachic standpoint. It's not opposite in. It's not that, well, we're going to, well, because we have such a high, you know, integration rate in terms of our own family, so we're going to have to kind of conform the halacha to the reality that we're dealing with. That's not how we observe Yiddishkeit. We embrace the halacha and we apply it, but we have a very heightened sensitivity. We have a consciousness that so many people in our community and our own families are part of this discussion. It's not an abstract thing.
Don't you think a lot of it's just also the fact that this is this shul is, we've got, you know, doctors, lawyers, all kinds of people constantly interacting with non-Jews and non-religious Jews, and I think we also appreciate them better because we know them as human beings, you know, and I think that is just, and that's the same kind of thing where we say, hey, you want to come to our house for Pesach, or you want to come to our shul or something like that. I think that's a big part of it also.
So these things, and this is kind of what Dr. Shane's is alluding to, and it relates a little bit to what we talked about.
I'm waiting for 2.5 months and ask Dr., not Jeff.
All right.
Yeah.
He shows up. Now he wants to be like, intense, like he was here.
What is the boy? Yeah.
That's right. All right. I don't want to be Jesus covered. But so last week we talked about religious Zionism, and one of the core issues was not so much the Zionism per se, but what about the secular Zionists? These non-frum, anti-Torah, anti-religious people, and working with them. So this question of how much and how little we encourage or allow that kind of interaction is at the heart of this issue. You know, and so there are people who would say, you know, we want to put up walls. Let's give, so that's one, that was kind of, it's a perfect segue to, you know, what are the nafgaminas? What are areas in which this comes up? So this is one of them in terms of encouraging engagement. And on what level? In what context? You know, there is a mitzvah, I'll get to you in 1 second, Paul. There's a mitzvah of Ahavas Yisrael. It's a very important mitzvah. So much so that many, we have a practice in the morning. It's taught, I think, it's in the Chabad Siddur. They say maybe from the Arizal, that before they say the davening in the morning, what do they say? They accept upon themselves, some people, to mekayim the mitzvah of Ahavta L'Re'acha Kamocha. First thing in the morning. So, to whom does the mitzvah of Ahavta L'Re'acha Kamocha apply? Who is your Re'ah? Who is your friend? Is that including somebody who is not itcha b'torah v'mitzvos, who is not on the same path with you about Torah and mitzvos? We know there is a mitzvah of tochacha, of rebuke, of setting people straight, because when we have the opportunity to influence others and we don't, v'kashlu ishbachim, the Gemara says that we're responsible if we don't set it right. Well, who does that apply to? There is the legal definition, for example, for Kabbalas Eidus, for serving as a witness. You know, you go to a court case or to a wedding or to a divorce proceeding. What is the halachic standing of somebody who is conservative, reform, reconstruction, is totally secular, assimilated, apostate, right? These are all cases. Yeah. And during different times in history, you had different kinds of questions. In the times of Rashi and the Balei HaTosfos, you didn't have Reconstructionism. You had people who were mishumadim. They became apostates and they came back to the community. And it was sometimes hard to figure out. In those days, if you were a Jew and you were a known Jew, so that had economic repercussions. That's the bottom line. You know, today, thank God, that's not so much the case. So trying to figure out whether you were not Jewish one day in the 12th century, and then you were Jewish the next day. Well, in those days, the boundaries were easier. If you were not in the Jewish community, you didn't live in the Jewish community. You lived with non-Jews, etc. So legal statuses. What happens when you leave the community, you come back? For those who remember, several years ago, Rabbi Ephraim Kanterfogel, Dr. Kanterfogel came. He gave a whole shiur about this. Rashi and Tosfos coming back, a whole complicated story. What about davening? This is where a lot of the questions come up. Can you be mitzaref somebody to a minyan? You know, you're standing in an office building, or you're going somewhere, or we moved to the new house this week, and one of the neighbors came over to introduce himself, and he's very friendly, and he made some kind of comment like, well, if you need a minyan, I guess maybe you could call me. Let's just say he's not from the regular minyan goers. I don't want to say, God forbid, anything about his driving habits on Shabbos, but I'm just saying, he just wanted me to know that he's Jewish. So can you count such a person for a minion? What about a coin for duchening? These are questions. And then in the tshuvas, they talk about another, not so common today, but does come up sometimes, another question, I guess maybe it depends what your lifestyle is, stam yenam, wine that was handled by somebody who is not observant. So does that disqualify the wine? Because you know that if you have, a lot of our wine is called mevushal, which means that it's not subject to being restricted if it's handled by somebody who's not Jewish. So that's why if you go to a wedding and you see a non-Jewish server, so they're pouring the wine, you don't have to worry. You look on the bottle, the hashgacha makes sure that it has a status of mevushal. But what if you have non-mevushal wine and you have somebody at the table and they pick up the bottle of wine and they pour you a cup, or they pour themselves a cup? So does that disqualify all the wine? And then v'chahena v'chahena. There's so many, a lot of these halachic questions. Yeah, Paul, what were you going to
do? I was just going to add, I think this is a huge topic for the day schools.
For the what?
The schools, our schools. And what are they teaching? What kind of approach they're teaching our kids?
Mm-hmm.
And I know just from our experience, that kids can go to school here, but one of these, you have to, as parents, be very tuned in to what our kids are learning in schools. We quite often had to redirect, particularly because many of the schools, the Lehi Kodesh teachers, actually are not from this community. And so I don't know to what extent if this is discussed amongst
and that's true, by the way. I agree with you.
100%.
What you're pointing out is that we need to be responsible in terms of how we're machanech our kids. That's true for this issue and all the issues that we've been talking about all year. But the truth is, it starts with us. You know, it's, I don't know, you know, to what extent everybody, I can tell you for myself, this has been a journey in learning and exploring and growing. We need to be educated and inspired to have a Torah authentic approach to all of these issues. And then we need to be able to articulate them, and we need to foster a conversation around these important issues from the Makoros, not because we made them up or invented them, but because they are genuine Masorah. That's what it's all about. So yeah, we have to be able to pass them along also. And we have to be able to create and compensate educators from our community. You know, this is a whole nother editorial, but if we educate our children about getting their own education, which would be commensurate with a certain level of a salary, and then we invest a salary that is a fraction of that into the role of the educator, well, we're not going to attract. You know, I see it from a Kollel standpoint. We have to compensate Kollel fellows in our Kollel differently than other Kollelim compensate fellows in other communities. Our fellows are, generally speaking, college-educated, graduate degrees, have a lot of other professional opportunities, but we want to invest in our community. So the people who support the Kollel, part of what they're supporting is the future of our rabbis and educators, but that is a very high cost. Some of our Kollel fellows have to take a pay cut to leave the Kollel to go into some of the educational roles, which is a very big challenge, because then we ask, well, why is it that our children don't have role models and educators who are adherents and proponents of this Masorah? So it's a much bigger discussion. But yeah, the educational piece is a big piece. Is a big piece of it. So
you could also relate to the fact of many of us have grown children. How if they go a slightly different way? If you could relate to that.
So that's kind of something we alluded to earlier, which is that on the one hand we say, you know, that we want to pass on our Masorah to our children. On the other hand, it's Chanoch L'Nar Al Pi Darko. For some kids, this Masorah is not the right Masorah for them. They need and want and will ultimately follow something different. So it's important that our community has, the same way we've talked about many times, there are 13 gates to Yerushalayim. Every kid has to find their gate. You know, for some people, they're going to be inspired by Rav Lichtenstein. For other people, they just, they cannot, they just... they can't connect. So they're going to find something else. And that's good. And we should encourage them. Yeah.
You know, perhaps you're going to get to this, but I just hope you do. If you have relatives or friends and you want to recommend them to go to Rabbi Danishevsky's program in the Northbrook area, and these people are conservative. They label themselves as conservative Jews. The response that I got was, Rena, trying to convert me.
Mm-hmm.
How do you respond to that? Because aren't we really trying to convert them?
Okay, so that's a very good question. It probably depends on who you are and what your perspective is on that specific question, because what you're alluding to is, well, let's say you have, I guess we'll kind of touch on it a little bit, but we'll address it now just for a second. You have people in your orbit, in your circle of influence, who are not observant. And let's say you take the approach that you want to try to educate them. So that could come from one of two places. It could come from a place of tochacha, of rebuke, that you need to be mochiach people who are doing the wrong thing. It could come from the mitzvah of arvus, of feeling the mutual relationship that we have with other Jews. So we want to make sure that they perform mitzvahs just like we perform mitzvahs. But part of it also relates to the idea of ultimately who's responsible, which is the first approach says, well, I'm really responsible. The second approach says, well, I'm only responsible to the extent that I have influence. So in the context of tochacha, I think it was the Magen Avraham or the Taz, somebody makes the point that tochacha comes in the context of relationship. Meaning, it's not that I'm necessarily the influencer or the changer. It's that I have a relationship and that my relationship can help that person appreciate something. So if you're talking about our approach in terms of the Kolo has continued to grow, as many of you know, beyond just the Orthodox community and now with the whole MCJL component. Well, our job is to teach people Torah. That's what we do, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And it shouldn't matter when we're teaching Torah whether it's somebody who has been observant, who hasn't been observant, who's going to become observant, who will never be observant. Our job is to teach people Torah. And then the same way that we teach Torah at this table and people incorporate it into their lives in the context that they, you know, are prepared. So the same thing, so some people would tell you, yes, our success of our enterprise would be how many people at the end of the journey become from. That's one approach. From the Kolo's perspective, we have a different goal. Our goal is to teach Torah. And the more people who are more engaged in Torah, the Torah has this very unusual, magical quality that it can influence and impact a person's life very often in a tremendously positive way. It could be a sum of this, but generally speaking, you know, our job is to give people Torah, and we're not trying to convert people. Some people disagree with us about that, and they're entitled to that opinion, but we're getting off topic a little bit. Yeah, Glenn.
Well, to that point, for many years, I would ask Rabbi Sarah Bettinger for to answer my questions. And whenever I'd say, you know, can I go here? Can I do this? He would say, are there going to be non-observant Jews there? And that would always be his first question. And the reason was actually, he told me later, was that if possibly he could say yes, where normally he would say no, if there were non-religious Jews there, he would say yes. Because to go there, not to convert them, but just to make them think that a little bit more about Orthodoxy and challenge their assumptions about how everything's a no, and you can't do this, and you can't do that. So just challenge their assumptions just by being yourself, but being there.
So let's get back. I'm going to kind of move on a little bit because we could go much farther afield with this.
Yeah.
If you look in the classical sources, there are different gradations for how to deal or how to categorize, because in halacha, we always ask questions like, well, what is this? What is the status of this thing? What is the issue involved? Then sometimes we'll ask why, but oftentimes when we look at something with a halachic eye, we're going to look at it and say, well, what is it? So in the classical sources, you didn't have, you know, a conservadox. That wasn't a thing. You didn't have that. In the times of the Gemara, you had someone called Mumar. So a Mumar, somebody who is not observant, could be what's called a Mumar L'Teyavon. Teyavon, what does B'Teyavon means? It's delicious.
Right.
So some people would eat non-kosher food because it was delicious. If they had kosher food and non-kosher food in front of them, they would eat the kosher. But if they have delicious non-kosher food in front of them and they don't have kosher food, so they would eat it because it's delicious. That's one kind of person who's not observant. It's not that they hate religion. It's not that they hate God. God forbid. It's that they're hungry. And they are not strong enough in their conviction to say, you know what? I know I'm in the, you know, I'm at the Clara Barton rest area on the New Jersey Turnpike, and that hot dog smells so good, and I'm going to have to wait another hour and a half to get to, you know, wherever I'm going. So they're hungry. They don't have the willpower to say, I'm just going to buy that high caloric, unhealthy snack from the snack machine that has an OU that's going to get me to the next exit. So that's one kind of person. It's not that they're angry at God. It's that they don't have the willpower, you know. And we're not judging. We're just, this is, as we say, like to say, just the facts, ma'am. Right? We're not judging. We're just saying there are people, that's one thing. It's hard for them to withstand that challenge. And God forbid, we should never be in their place. It's very easy to judge people if we're not in their place. That's number one. Then the Gemara says there are people who are what's called mumar ochel nevelas l'teyavon. Excuse me, lahachis. Person eats non-kosher food, lahachis. Because he wants to kivyachol for whatever reason that he's feeling so burnt out and obviously his relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is so broken that he's in a state where he's, you know, it's like a, you ever see that where the little kids, they start throwing the Cheerios at the parents? Does the kid really hate the parent? No, the kid doesn't hate the parents. He's just having a temper tantrum, so he's throwing the Cheerios. So Rahman al-Islam, there were people over the generations who would throw Cheerios at God, and they would do that by eating non-kosher food and driving on Shabbos with all kinds of things. That's another category. That's mumar lahachis. Then if you look in the Rishonim, there's a lot of discussion about something called a mishumad. Mishumad is an apostate. Somebody converts, oftentimes, let's say, certainly in Ashkenazic context, that means they converted to Christianity. And then later, after things got rough for Sephardic Jews, you know, the Rambam has a famous letter talking about what happens to people who converted to Christianity when they were in very difficult straits in Spain. Unfortunately, not everybody, in fact, tens of thousands of Jews did convert to Christianity. So that's called a mishumad. The Gemara then has another qualification. Let's say a person's not mumar ochel nevelos. Let's say they are mechalel Shabbos bifarhesia. They are a public Sabbath desecrator. So that's another kind of person. So there's a difference between a mumar, somebody who's not observant because they're hungry, versus somebody who's not observant because they are spiteful, capricious. Then you have somebody who's not either of those, but they are a Sabbath desecrator. So the Gemara says, well, there's a difference between a Mechal Shabbos bifarhesia, somebody who does that publicly, or somebody who doesn't do it publicly. Now, publicly today sometimes has a different context, although there's a lot of discussion about that. I used to lane when I was in college in a certain shul in a certain suburb of New York City, in the New York tri-state area, we'll say. So they would have a joke in that shul, because the vast majority of the members of the community were not, they certainly didn't grow up Orthodox. And even at that time, you know, one fellow who got psicha for Ne'ila, his cell phone rang just mamish. I don't know if it was the Ribbono Shel Olam calling him or it was somebody who worked in his hedge fund who was calling him for psicha for Ne'ila. It happens. So that was the kind of shul. So they used to have a joke. They used to have a joke in the shul, and we'll see how, you know, it kind of alludes to something that Glenn was talking about. When you have an Orthodox shul that welcomes people like that, it gives those people an opportunity to get closer to the Ribbono Shel Olam through authentic Torah Judaism, through a Masorah, that if you threw them out and built a wall, they wouldn't have that opportunity, but we'll save that for later. There was a joke that, you know, depending on Purim, they would say, pull it in. What do they mean, pull it in? Because on Shabbos, when people would drive to shul, they would park around the corner. So it shouldn't say that they're going to park in the driveway on Shabbos. But on Purim, you know, go explain to somebody that there's an Issur Melacha on this holiday, there's no Issur Melacha on that holiday. We just say, on Purim, pull it in. Pull it in. Everybody can park in the driveway. You don't have to be. So what does that tell you? That's the kind of Mechal Shabbos. That's not a Mechal Shabbos Bifar Hesya. That person is not a wanton Sabbath desecrator. They understand that in the synagogue, it's not appropriate to drive on Shabbos. It happens to be they're not there. That's not where their Avodas Hashem is holding, unfortunately. They didn't yet appreciate the beauty of Shabbos. But they understand it's not. They wouldn't drive up to the rabbi's house on Shabbos. So they're not, it's not like they're parading around.
Respectful.
They're respectful because it's not just that they're respecting the synagogue. It's that they're respecting the synagogue because they understand, if you were to ask them, they know that the tradition would not allow them to do that. They'll tell you, honestly, they're not there. That's not where they are. They're driving on Saturday. But
they still came to shul.
Yes, and they understand that in the shul, that's not proper. And so there's an element of, I don't want to say busha, but there's an element of understanding that that's not proper. So they have an element of tzinah. They want to disguise it. They want to hide it. Everybody knows they drove. That's not the point. The point is they respect the fact that it's not the right thing. So there's not wanton Shabbos desecrators. So there's a big discussion. Well, what about the fact that everybody knows that they drive versus the fact... But the Gemara has an Erevin, an example, because it comes up in Hilchos Erevin sometimes, question about a mumar. Well, somebody who's embarrassed in front of the rabbi. I love this amazing story about Rabbi Ari Levin. Rabbi Ari Levin had such Ahavas Yisrael for all Jews, so that there was a guy, a Chiloni guy. He probably would never use the word Chiloni ever. So there was a Chiloni guy who was one of the prisoners in the Palestine prison in Yerushalayim. He used to go visit there all the time. So he would go on Shabbos to visit the prisoners. So there was a non-religious fellow who was smoking a cigarette on Shabbos. And he saw that Rabbi Ari Levin came into the prison, but he couldn't get rid of the cigarette. So what did he do? He swallowed it! He swallowed it while it was lit. Why? Because how could it be that Rabbi Ari Levin, the tzaddik from Yerushalayim, should see him smoking a cigarette on Shabbos? So that's, if the Gemara in Erevin were to give you an example of somebody who's Mechal Shabbos Betzina, everybody knows he's not a Shabbos observant person, but if Rabbi Ari Levin is there, he's not going to sit smoking a cigarette in front of Rabbi Ari Levin. He swallowed the cigarette. So that is another distinction that the Gemara has between Befarhesia and Betzina. And then the last distinction that we could talk about in a contemporary context is maybe there's a difference between a secular person, somebody who identifies in the Pew Research study as non-denominational at all, unaffiliated. That's one kind of Jewish person who's not observant. And then you have somebody else who's Jewish and affiliates with a particular denomination, that they assume or they say that they're religious, they're just conservative, or they're reform, or they're reconstructionist, or renewal, whatever brand of Judaism, they're saying that this is. And for us, the Masorah is the sole arbiter of Judaism. Torah is only Torah Moshe, that's Torah Shebichsav, Torah Shebalpeh, that we spoke about at such great length. So maybe those two could also be distinguished. So when we talk about how to figure out what we're looking at in terms of halachic definitions, and these come up all the time. Somebody appears before the CRC Beis Din. They had a certain case of a get, or they had a wedding, and they had people in the crowd. Well, who was in the crowd? Who was the officiating rabbi? Who were the witnesses? These things come up all the time. Ma'asim b'chol yom. Ma'asim b'chol yom. Some of them come up also in the context of a minyan, like we spoke about, and some of them, unfortunately, Rav Shechter Shlita, my Rebbe, we used to point out, he rues the fact, he says, he remembers when he was a kid that sometimes the Kohanim would go up to Duchen and he would hear their change jingling in their pocket. And he says, today, he says, it's unfortunate that we don't have that anymore because a lot of those people don't come to Orthodox shuls. His father was a rabbi in Philadelphia for many years. He said, people used to come, someone told me, this is obviously well before my time, that the Hashkama Minyan phenomenon started because there were people who went to work. They went to work. And that's why if you look in some of the early tshuvas that we'll talk about in a little bit, they acknowledge this phenomenon. Now, that's not a mumar, that's a question, is that a Mechal Shabbos b'farhesia, not b'farhesia? You know, is that a mumar l'teyavon? Is that a mumar l'achas? These are questions. So there are different approaches. So there's one approach they quote from the name of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. And this, I also saw it, Rabbi Ries has an article in one of those an Orthodox Forum articles. He quotes from the Minkacher, the Minchas Eluzer, who now, if you put all these Masorah components together, you're going to kind of the Munkácsa is the very well-known Hungarian outspoken anti-Zionist figure. So they quote from Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim used to say, apparently, a Nebuch Apikoros is Oichen an Apikoros. You didn't grow up observant? Well, it doesn't matter. If you're an Apikoros, you're an Apikoros. It doesn't matter how you grew up. Even if it was Nebuch, that you didn't have that education. And they quote some very strong opinions from the Minchas Elazar, the Munkácsa, who says, you know, you should treat people who are rachok, you should be merachik, the rachokim. You should keep them away. Because you have to build a wall around your community to protect the integrity of your Masorah. So if you have people who are not observant, the best thing is push them away, keep them away. At arm's length, yeah.
Don't we hold dear that?
Well, that's what we're about to get to. They absolutely... The Minchas Elazar and many others absolutely, categorically, completely reject that approach, which is what we're about to get to right now.
Every one of these could fall almost into that category.
So we're going to get to that. That's a question, if it can or can't. So that'll segue us to the other approach, which is that we don't try to distance people who are not observant. We don't try to throw them out and stay away from them. Quite the opposite. We try to embrace people who are not observant. And that comes from... Maybe the place to start is an important tshuva. This tshuva, you can call it a landmark tshuva. It's a watershed tshuva. It's authored by Rav Yaakov Ettlinger in the Shalos and Tshuvas Binyan Sion. Rav Yaakov Ettlinger was, maybe is known to you in a different context, he was the Rebbe of Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. So... Where was he living and when was he living?
Germany.
19th century. Okay. So the Binyan Sion has a section of tshuvas, a small section. This is very interesting. The small section is titled Psakim Shelo Lahalacha Lamaase. Psakim that are not halacha lamaase. Not halacha lamaase. Because usually responsible, of course, are halacha lemaisa. So he was asked about this question about yayin, maga yayin, stam yenam, wine in non-Orthodox circles, non-Orthodox Jews. Because now you know that after the 18th century and the wave of enlightenment and the upheaval, the total upheaval of the Haskalah beginning in Germany, so... Vast swaths, the vast majority of German Jews by the 19th century are not traditional Torah observant Jews. So the Binyan Sion has a suggestion. And the title is Shelo Lamaisa. And he says, I'm not sure about this. I'm not sure. But he says, maybe the categories that we talked about in the Gemara about Mumar and what the halachic nafkaminas of that are, maybe that's different today. Maybe it's different today, because if somebody grew up in a non-Orthodox milieu and they were never educated, that's similar to something called etinok shenishba bein hagoyim. What is that? So the Gemara in the seventh parak of Shabbos talks about somebody who violates the laws of Shabbos and has to bring a korban chatas, because Shabbos is one of the most severe onshim. It's iser skila and iser karis, it's a chiyuv chatas. If a person, I don't know, goes outside and plants flowers on Shabbos, they have to bring a chatas for planting flowers on Shabbos. But the laws of chatas are complex because they require something called a yediya, an awareness. So the Gemara has a discussion about when exactly you need a yediya. You definitely need a yediya afterwards. How else would you bring a chatas if you didn't know you did something wrong? The question is, well, what about a yediya beforehand or a yediya in the middle? So there's a machlokas between a chachamim and it's a munbaz. It's a whole discussion there. But one of the Gemara's suggestions is, well, what happens if you have someone who's a tinok shenishba bein hanochrim, like Tarzan? This child was brought up in the wolves, didn't know anything about human culture. Well, what about lahavdil, of course, a child from a Torah perspective who was raised in a convent, never knew that they were Jewish, never knew anything about Judaism. So how does that relate to the din of a chatas if they never even had a yediyah, an awareness before at all? They had no education. They had no hasagas. The Gemara has a whole discussion about this concept of tinuk shenishba in the context of chiyuv chatas. So the Binyan Tzion is kind of borrowing this concept to say, well, this person who's brought up in the German, 1830s, modern, secular context, this assimilated Jew, how can you call them a mumar? It's hard to call them a mumar. It's hard to know. So that begins, even though it's a psak halacha l'maisa, it says, I'm not sure, that begins a whole trend of discussion that now is picked up by later poskim. Now, it's an interesting question, before I give you another German posik who relates to this issue. There is a sefer that quotes some different, I think it's called Madane Shlomo, quotes different opinions from Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who was in favor of embracing the secular Jews in Israel, but he wonders, can you really call a Jew who was raised in Israel in the 1970s, can you call that person a Tinuk Shenishba? Is that the same? Hard to say, right? It's hard to know. Can you really categorize that person as Tinuk Shenishba? Or, maybe you might treat them like a Tinuk Shenishba, but they might not be technically a Tinuk Shenishba. Maybe they were raised on a secular kibbutz, so they know there's something called Shabbos and Yom Kippur and stuff. But so this is a complicated thing. But this idea of viewing secular non-Orthodox Jews as a Tinuk Shenishba is going to be picked up later. So there was a great gaon. His name was Rav David Zvi Hoffman. He wrote the Shilas and Tshuvas Malamed Lahoel. He died in the early 20s. He was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Beis Medrash LaRabbanim, the Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary. He was a great gaon, an author of Tshuvas and Sfarim on Chumash. So he was asked a Shilas from his community. I think it was called Kahal Adas Yeshurun or Kahal Adas Yereim. He had a shul in Berlin, and they were asked about a Mechal Shabbos, can that person be mitzarf to a minyan? So he says, well, there was a guy who came to the shul, and the gabbai of the shul, the name was Kahal, where is it? Ashkenaz, where is it? I forget. He gives the name of their shul. So he quotes the Binyan Tzion, and he says, there are many who don't view these people who are not observant as Mechal Shabbos Befarhes Yadino Ka'akam. But he says, in our shul, the Gabbai kind of discouraged this guy for coming to the Minyan. So you know what happened? He went to another Minyan, to the Chevr Shas Minyan, and they let him be part of it. He says, and the Chevr Shas, they had great gedolim and rabbanim, and they were never moche. And he quotes a bunch of tshuvas from the Binyan Tzion and many others, who says that, look, this person is not a mumar l'chol haTorah kula, even though he's a Mechal Shabbos. He's not called. And therefore, ech sheyeh, however it'll be, hameka letzarf anashim ke'elu l'minyan yesh mal milas moch. However, if you can go to shul without relying on that, okay, it's nach besser. But he relies on this Binyan Tzion. He says they're not really dino ka'akum. So that's kind of one idea. There is another idea in this approach, the more embracing approach. It's a letter from Rav Kook in the Igros 138, where Rav Kook kind of takes another halachic category and applies it. The Gemara has an idea which is not in this context, but Rav Kook expands it. And this idea is called onus. What does onus literally mean? It literally means coerced. Means coercion. So nobody today is being coerced to being secular. However, Rav Kook draws on an idea that Tosus mentions in the context of a man who gets involved with a woman who he wasn't supposed to get involved with, but this woman was pursuing him so strongly, and the Yetzer Hara for this man was so overwhelming. Tosfos says, well, that sounds almost like an onus. Like he couldn't control himself because he was in such a situation that it was overwhelming. Rav Kook says, look at the times that we're living in. Rav Kook wrote something called Ma'amar Hador, where he talks about the turbulent times, that the upheaval that Europe was going through in the end of the 19th century, early 20th century. Look at these times. He says, these people who are in this environment, they're almost, again, it's not exactly, but it's similar to being onus. They're overwhelmed by the tide. You know, you put somebody, sometimes you take an impressionable person and you put them in intellectual context where they're no match for the arguments that are being put against them. So Rav Kook has this similar idea. He doesn't go with Tinuk Shenishba, but he goes with the idea like an onus, kind of like coerced, a mass onus. And then the Chazon Ish, so you've gone from the 19th century to the Binyan Zion, to the early 20th century with the Malam and the Hol, Rav David Zvi Hoffman, to Rav Kook a little bit later, and then to the Chazon Ish later, where the Chazon Ish writes in two places in his Chidushim. The Chazon Ish was, of course, you know, the great Gaon of Bnei Brak. Chazon Ish writes, the Gemara has a din, the Rambam paskins it, called Moridin Ve'in Malin, where you take certain apikorsim and you kick them into the ditch on the side of the road, and hopefully they get killed by marauders, so they fall into the pit and they never get out and they die a miserable death. Chazon Ish says, Moridin Ve'in Malin, what's the point of that din? The point of that din is to get rid of all the ra in the world. He says, but today, we're not really getting rid of the ra when we do that. We're just going to get people more aggravated. You know, the best way to get rid of the ra is to embrace people, is to show them that Yiddishkeit is beautiful and that the Ribbon Shalom has a connection for them. And so instead of throwing them off the building, maybe invite them in for a cup of coffee. And then, oh, right? Amazing. And then the Chazon Ish also writes, he says, you know, a lot of these halachas, they only apply to people that you already were mochiach them. You rebuke them. You educated them. You told them this is allowed, this is not allowed. So the Gemara has an expression, Horius, where the Tanoim have a discussion about Tochacha. One of them says, you know, today we don't have people who are adequately capable of really rebuking somebody appropriately. That was in the times of the Tanoim. Chazon Ish quotes the Chafetz Chaim in the Sefer Avas Chesed. He quotes from the Maharam Lublin and others. They say, we don't have anybody who's capable of being mochiach today. Who is capable of adequately, really, effectively being mochiach someone? So Chazon Ish says, a lot of these halachas don't apply because it's after Tochacha. Now others disagree with this Chazon Ish. But you start to put these things together and you develop a different approach. It's not an approach of rejection. It's not an approach that is excusing. And it's not condoning, but it's relating to the people with love, with approachability, with an open hand. And I think this approach is the approach that is generally taken in our community. Yeah.
So I have to say this, Rabbi Grant. The modern Orthodox show that I go to up north, that Rabbi Grant knows.
Yes.
I was raised in West Rogers Park. The majority of people that I go to show with are Baal Shuvas. So not just on Shabbos, because these people are my friends. There's validation. A good friend of mine's husband never even had a bar mitzvah. His daughters are married to rabbis, and everything that you're saying is so validated.
All right, that's good. Life. All right, good. At least we got, we scored, okay. Yeah. We got, okay. Good.
Stop.
No, that's good.
So,
okay, good. And that's part of what the Chazon Ish was saying, is that if you relate to people, you never know, you know, where it could bring them with the light, the Or Shebo Machzir on the Mutav. So that has a powerful impact rather than building a wall and saying, you have to stay on the other side. So we're going to get close to being over time, but I want to conclude with two notes that relate to this point in terms of how we kind of apply this, because these are very general. You know, there's the build a wall. Maybe that's a loaded term in today's political climate. Who pays for that wall? I don't know. Is the wall? I'm stepping into a line. And then there's not the wall. There's the discussion. There's the light. There's the love. There's the bringing people close. And then it relates in different ways. But That does not mean that we condone or approve of any, you know, specific type of thing. So what about the actual status? So you can now talk about kind of a nuance. It's not a wholesale rejection or acceptance. You know, when you edit a document in Microsoft Word, there is accept all and reject all changes. It's not like that. It doesn't have to be like that. There's a more nuanced approach. What, you know, in terms of somebody who's an actual mumar, there's an amazing tshuva, a very important tshuva in the Sridi Eish that others articulate a similar idea. They quote from Rav Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, that there's a difference between Kedushas Yisrael, the sanctity of a Jewish person, versus the, I don't want to call them rights, but the kind of the benefits of being part of a Jewish community. You take somebody who's a meshumad, who's a mumar, the Ribbono Shel Olam has unconditional love for that person. And that is a bond that can never be broken, no matter how destructive their acts are, ever, ever, ever. But if that person renounces their Judaism, which on a deep level they can't do, but then it's difficult to really say, well, now you're going to be part of our community when they refuse to be part of our community. So you can say, because you're going to go through the sugya when you go home and start looking up all these makoros and all these articles, and you finish, you know, 3 weeks of makoros and sugyas and everything, you're going to be like, well, how does it break down? So the answer could be that it's nuanced. Somebody could throw away Judaism, become a Catholic priest, but they're Yisrael, afal pi shechat Yisrael. The Ribbono Shel Olam will always take them back. Always. Even Yeravam ben Nevat, the horrible wicked king, the Chazal say the Ribbono Shel Olam was willing to take him back. Even the people, in lam chelek lomabo, the Gemara says, yeah, there are people who say, Dorashi Rishumas, they do have. The Ribbono Shel Olam always has a place. But that doesn't mean that we're going to treat them always the same way. It doesn't mean they're going to be kosher laitis to be considered part of the Jewish community. That's one thing to keep in mind. That's A. B, there is a very important essay, and now the truth is each of these ideas really needs its own shiur, but otherwise we'd be here forever. That's essay number one is the tshuva of the Sridi Eish, of Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, about the difference between not losing your status as a Jew, but maybe losing your rights and privileges if you renounce your part of the Jewish community. The second point is Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Zichron Levracha. Rav Aaron has an essay in Logic of the Heart, Logic of the Mind, where he distinguishes between friendship and fellowship. The Mishnah says in the beginning of Pirkei Avos in Perek Aleph, Al tischaber l'Rasha. Don't connect to become a chaver to a Rasha. So Rav Aaron says, that means if you have somebody who's not itcha b'torah mitzvahs, not imcha, not with you in observance, it means you should maintain a distance from them. But he says that's only in the context of al tischaber, to be a chaver, to be a fellow. It means that somebody who doesn't share our values, we shouldn't go out drinking with them and going socially interacting with them in a case where that's going to have a negative influence on us. But it doesn't mean that we can't have friendship. It means, he says, we can't have fellowship. That's why there are a lot of social restrictions, especially with non-Jews, but potentially also with, a mumer that's dino ka'akum, that would be the same concept. That maybe that's not going to be the best influence in your life, but it doesn't mean that you can't work together. Rav Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, there are a lot of people who talk about the distinction between klape chutz and klape pnim. External issues, fighting anti-Semitism, we can all fight with the BDS movement together. We can all stand together to figure that out. Internal Torah issues or social fraternizing, that's not the same thing. But these distinctions are important to keep in mind. So distinction number one is between not losing your Shem Yisrael versus the privileges. Distinction number two is between fellowship, which is going to be limited. We don't want to be mischaber with Russia. We don't want to be living and immersing ourselves in values that are antithetical to our core beliefs. That's exactly what we saw last week with the Mizrahi program, where the Mizrahi program said, we're going to have our own conference, so we maintain our integrity. But what did the Mizrahi say? We're going to use the same blue pushkas. Because that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik would say that's friendship, that's buying trees. Similarly, Rav Soloveitchik had this distinction between klapei pnim, internal Torah issues, where we don't have in common, versus external. And I'll end with one last point. I know we're over time. I apologize. Anybody needs to run, run now. There was a rabbi, a conservative rabbi in Boston, whose name is Rabbi Joseph Shubau. He was a close friend of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. And so Rav Soloveitchik, studying Rav Soloveitchik's approach to this issue is important because it informs us about one of our great Bali Masorah. You know that in 1956, there was a Psak Din that was signed by the greatest Torah giants of the generation, prohibiting participation in synagogue councils having non-Orthodox denominations, conservative and reform. It was signed by Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Yitzchak Huttner, and Rav David Lifshitz, and Rav Avram Yaffin, and many others. Rav Soloveitchik did not sign, which is interesting. Because on the other hand, Rav Soloveitchik was a strident and vocal opponent of conservative Judaism, so much so that in one of his public letters, he describes how we're going to have to fight again, conservative Judaism. He says, not on a personal level, but on a hashkafic, Masorah ideological level. Some of us were here, if you remember, when we told the story about the shofar blowing. Mezazeah. The guy called the Rav and said, I don't have a shofar in my town. Can I go hear the shofar on Rosh Hashanah? And what did he say? No. And the guy called him back and he begged him and he pleaded. And the Rav said, you cannot cross the threshold of that conservative synagogue, even if it means you will not hear the mitzvah d'oraisa of tkiyah shofar on Rosh Hashanah. So the Rav had a nuanced position. So he had this friend, Rabbi Shubau. Rabbi Shubau supported him when he was being harassed by a bunch of gangster shochtim, meatpackers, when the Rav was trying to protect the shochtim and install better standards for them. They had terrible working conditions, and the shechita was a very difficult circumstance, so he tried to help them. So the meatpackers were very opposed to him. So they attacked him for racketeering, all kinds of things. So this Rabbi Shubau supported him, and they were good friends for many years. Rabbi Shubau was having a new, they were having a Chanukah Sabayis for a new conservative temple. So there are several letters, and these are published in the Community Conversation Commitment, forget the Community Commitment, Community, something, it's all C's, anyway, three C's. Three C's, you'll find the book, it's from the Torah Sarav, where Rabbi Shubau, the shul, I think his name was Philip Fleischer, sent an invitation to the Rav to serve as an honorary chair of this dinner. And the Rav responded. And the Rav said, look, I appreciate my friendship with Rabbi Shubau, and I'm not a preacher, and I've never been, and I'm not going to preach to you, and I've never tried to convert people to my way of life. But if I were to come to your dinner, it would be tantamount to acceding to a congregation that has mixed views. And he said, that would be a violation of my conscience. Rabbi Shubau writes a personal letter to Rav Soloveitchik that I have here also that's not in the book, where he says, I would so much, he says, we live in a goyish world. This is what he writes. And so we have all these cheshbonos. He says, I know they invited you to the dinner. He says to the Rav, I would prefer to disinvite everybody else to the dinner except for you. It would mean so much to me for you to be there. But, he says, I understand that it's not from your place that you could come to my dinner. So this is where it comes back to, I think, where we need to finish up, which is, number one, the idea of nuance, that Rav Soloveitchik had a nuanced position on how to deal with issues of, you know, interdenominational and non-observant. But the second thing, and this is where it comes back to, which is that we have to remember that Jews are Jews. Rav Soloveitchik has the idea of the covenant of destiny and the covenant of fate, similar to the Sridi Eish. Somebody may renounce the covenant of destiny, but they can never renounce the covenant of fate. Because when the Gestapo came, they didn't ask you, are you from this shul in Berlin or from that shul? Are you from the Malamud Lahoid shul or from the other shul? Are you from the covenant of fate doesn't distinguish. So even if we are going to disagree, and we're going to disagree strongly, stridently, and on very principled grounds, we have to be able to not forget that Jewish people are Jews. Even if you say there's no mitzvah of Avos Yisrael, but They still have the Shem Yisrael. That Shem Yisrael says the Sridi Eish can never be taken away, just like the Ribbono Shel'Olam's love for that person can never be taken away. So we have to be very sensitive and very careful that when we deal with these issues, we have to deal with the people, not just with the issues. And hopefully we'll have Siyata D'Shmaya to be Marba Kavod Shemayim in everything we do. Yes. 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 So, well, it depends. In yes. So the question is, who? What does it mean? Right? Right. What does it mean, Chaverim Kol Yisrael? Yes. Yes. Oh, yes. Every family is complicated. And by the way, even if your family is Orthodox, your family could be very complicated. Right?
But a lot of us
right?
Want to be, or you became religious, and your siblings aren't. Whatever. Is he saying that if you have, say,
who's saying?
Rabbi Soloveitchik, or how would this work if you have somebody who's having a bar or bat mitzvah that actually has a Jewish mother, but right. The bar or bat mitzvah is in a conservative?
Great question. So you have to ask your posek who follows your masorah to address your particular circumstance, knowing all of the particulars. Exactly. They are, yes, and they keep coming up. We keep dealing with them. All right, have a great week.